great, another political talk show. Just what America needs. It's time for something different. I figure if you're listening to me, you are obviously a person of very high intellect.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger. With your host, Kathy Wynn.
The saying goes that there are only two things certain in this life, death and taxes. But wait, apparently that's true for you and me. But not so much if you're General Electric or any number of other multi-billion dollar corporations who rake in billions of dollars in profit, but do not contribute one dime to the United States Treasury. In fact, General Electric pulled in an estimated $14.2 billion, yes, that's billion dollars, in worldwide operating profits in 2010. How much do they owe in taxes for all of that profit? Zero. I don't know about you folks, but my income falls considerably short of $14 billion, yet I'm paying Uncle Sam plenty this year in taxes. So, how does that happen that corporations who rake in billions from American consumers don't have to pay their taxes like you and I do? Our guest today is going to help us understand just exactly how our tax system provides ways for multi-billion dollar corporations to feed off of the consumer dollars of hardworking Americans, then pay nothing in taxes on those dollars that go into their own coffers. Attorney Craig M. Boies served as Director of Tax Programs and Director of the Institute for Offshore Financial Center Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. Professor Boies' research focused on U.S. international tax policy, offshore financial centers, and offshore financial intermediation. Craig is also author of an article entitled Breaking Offshore Piggy Banks, Deferral, and the Utility of Amnesty, as well as many other articles and research papers on the subject of corporate taxation. He is eminently qualified to speak on this topic, and it is my pleasure, great pleasure, to welcome him to our show. Craig, thank you so much for agreeing to be with us today and help our listeners and me try to understand this seemingly unfair system. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kathy. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I'm just going to start with going to a recent 60 Minutes segment that was just on a couple of weeks ago that reported on this particular area of tax law and how it is that multi-billion dollar corporations get away with cheating, and I'm just going to use that word because to me that's what it seems like, America, out of any taxes on their profits. And in the 60 Minutes segment, the reporter proposed that the problem and the reason for these companies being able to elude their tax responsibilities is that American taxes are actually just too darn high. So they have to escape our tax burden by setting up offshore operations in order to avoid America's exorbitant taxes. So I'm just going to ask you, how is that possible?
Well, Kathy, if you're management of a corporation, your goal is to maximize the return to shareholders on their investment in that corporation. And to the extent that taxes take away from that bottom line at all, they're too high. So it's not terribly surprising that corporations would consider the U.S. Tax rate to be too high, to the extent that anything north of zero. However, what you frequently see repeated in the Wall Street Journal, in particular, and other sort of business-oriented news outlets, is the statement that the U.S. has this 35% corporate tax rate, which is the highest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as a matter of, in one sense, that's true. That's the what we call in tax lingo, the marginal tax rate. That is, what does the tax code say the percentage of taxes that you have to pay? It's a 35% rate. However, what they actually pay is far less, and in some cases, like that of GE, an actual negative tax rate, which means they're actually collecting money rather than paying it, happens because there's so much in the way of corporate welfare that we offer to corporations in the U.S. So, for example, the research and development tax credit, interest allocation rules, all of which means that their effective tax rate is far less than the 35% that you often read about. Now, in terms of tax lingo again, the effective rate is the rate of tax that you pay when you take the actual dollar amount of taxes you pay and you divide that by the amount of income that you have. And that ends up being far less than the marginal rate. So I think it's important to keep those two concepts in mind. So GE does have to pay tax under the code at a rate of 35%, but we saw in the New York Times story, and I did not see the 60 Minutes piece, but I'm familiar with the issue. The actual effective rate is somewhere in the single digits or even less, depending on the corporation.
Well, they're able to claim all of these deductions. One of them you mentioned was research and development. And so how do they do that? They're able to claim that their research and development costs are so high that they then don't need to pay any taxes because of the deduction for all of that. But are those research and development costs actually benefiting American consumers?
Well, frequently, you know, the research and development credit is just one piece of the way that the tax bill actually gets reduced for corporations. Whether the research and development tax credit actually produces beneficial research is a subject of some debate. There are some economists who say that, you know, you get a lot of fabricated, useless research as a result of the fact that the government is providing a subsidy for.
Gosh, really? That is so surprising.
Right, but the other piece, and the piece I think that has been the focus of a lot of the news reports lately, is the use of offshore subsidiary corporations to keep dollars earned outside of the U.S. tax net. And I think that's probably the biggest single way in which U.S. multinational corporations are able to keep their tax bills so low. And the reason for that is that, let's say you're a U.S. corporation, you decide you want to do business offshore. So if you ship widgets to, let's say, Italy, and you sell widgets there, you earn money, you pay tax on those earnings in the United States, because in the U.S. we have a rule that says you pay tax on your income whether you earn it inside the United States or whether you earn it selling widgets in Italy.
Hmm.
By contrast, instead of selling widgets in Italy and paying U.S. tax, and by the way, you would also owe tax in Italy. So there's a potential for double taxation. We fix that problem, or we attempt to mitigate that problem by giving you a credit in the United States against your tax bill for the amount of the taxes that you paid in Italy.
Okay.
But let's suppose
you're paying taxes in Italy of 20%, and if your tax in the United States is 35%, then they allow you to deduct that 20% that you've paid to Italy?
Yeah, it's not okay. A deduction, it's a credit, which means okay. That the dollar amount, the difference between a deduction and a credit is the deduction goes into figuring what your income is. The credit goes to reduce on a dollar-for-dollar basis the amount of tax that you owe.
Okay.
So that's right. So then the only tax that would be owed would be the $15 or 15% differential.
Right.
U.S. and the tax in Italy.
Right.
But suppose instead that I, instead of simply selling widgets into Italy, I decide to form a subsidiary corporation in Italy. Now I have an Italian subsidiary, And the subsidiary in Italy sells the widgets instead of my corporation in the U.S. selling those widgets. Now that corporation is no longer a U.S. corporation. It's not a U.S. taxpayer. And so the widget income and profit that's made in Italy stays in Italy. Now that's how you would normally expect to operate in a foreign jurisdiction. The Italians would presumably tax the Italian corporation, the subsidiary, and all would be well. And then when the Italian subsidiary pays a dividend back to the parent corporation, then it would be taxed in the U.S., but not until that point. What has happened is that U.S. corporations have used subsidiary corporations in jurisdictions where there is no income tax as a place to park foreign earnings. So instead of having an Italian subsidiary, let's say you put a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands, there's no income tax in the Cayman Islands, so that subsidiary can hold those earnings without paying any tax in Cayman, and it would not pay any U.S. tax until those earnings are brought back on shore as a dividend to the parent corporation. Typically, the real big beneficiaries, and all U.S. multinationals utilize subsidiary corporations in these jurisdictions, but it's been particularly profitable for pharmaceutical and tech companies who can put their patents and other intellectual property in those corporations, in those jurisdictions. And then all the profit from the patent, because it's owned by the subsidiary, all the profits that are made once the drug begins to be made, or once the computer chips or whatever other thing that's being sold is made, the profit stays offshore in the subsidiary and is beyond the reach of U.S. Tax collectors. And that's really the problem. It's not illegal. It's not tax evasion. It's tax avoidance. The question is, what do we do about it? And, so far the response from the government has been largely colored by those who are paying a lot of money to lobbyists to say, give us a tax break when we bring this money back into the United States.
And what do you mean when they bring the money back into the United States, Craig?
Well, so again, let's assume I'm... Acme Corporation in the U.S. I have my scientists working on a patent for some sort of medication. And, of course, in the U.S., I potentially could get a research and development credit for the work that I'm doing on that patent. But let's say that I decide this patent is going to produce the next Viagra, and there's going to be billions of dollars to be made from this. So before I get too far along in the process, I assign or sell the patent to a subsidiary corporation that I own in, let's say, Cayman. Okay. Now my Cayman subsidiary owns that patent, and that corporation enters into agreements with, pill manufacturers in other parts of the world. They're getting paid a royalty in exchange for the right to use that patent to produce pills and sell them. So you've got these royalty payments coming into the Cayman Island corporation that owns the patent, and that money is piling up there. Now, the Cayman Corporation is controlled by the U.S. parent, but there's no U.S. tax until such time as that royalty money that's piling up in Cayman gets paid back to the U.S. corporation as a dividend. When that money is paid back, it would be typically taxed at 35%. In 2004, as part of the American Jobs Creation Act, there was a one-year window during which U.S. multinationals could bring that money back into the United States, not at the usual 35% rate, but at a reduced rate of 5.75%. In that one-year window of time, approximately $400 or so billion was brought back in the United States in dividends, paid from foreign subsidiaries back to U.S. parents, and taxed at 5.75%. that was only a one-year window, though, and that was the end of it. I wrote an article about this provision of the U.S. Jobs Creation Act. And by the way, the justification for this was, look, when these corporations bring this money back in the United States, they'll invest it in capital projects. They will create new jobs. This will be a great boon for the economy.
Man.
Of course, as you know, none of that happened. In fact, a lot of the money was actually used to shut down plants. It was used to buy out employees and give them early retirement. A lot of it was used for buyback of shares, which increased the share price of corporations and therefore the value of deferred compensation for executives. But it did nothing for the economy, and that's pretty widely recognized now. At the time, I wrote an article about this, the article that you referred to, Breaking Open Offshore Piggy Banks. And what I did in that article was look at this provision as something very much like a tax amnesty provision, something that you see quite frequently where, an amnesty provision of any sort, where, you know, your public library might say, look, we know there's a lot of people out there who have overdue books and you owe lots of fines, but if you bring those books back within the next 2 weeks, we'll forget the fines and we'll have our books back and we'll pretend we're all square. This happens frequently, particularly in other parts of the world where governments that have high levels of tax evasion will say, we're going to allow you to come forward, come clean, pay the tax, we won't impose any penalties, maybe we won't impose any interest, we won't put you in jail, we'll call it a day. We'll have revenue that we wouldn't have otherwise had, and you'll be all square with us. So in this article, I compared the provision of the American Jobs Creation Act with an amnesty provision, and I looked at what happens in terms of incentives when you have these sorts of provisions. And what invariably happens with tax amnesties is you might collect a lot of money the first time you issue or offer the amnesty. But then over time, you begin to collect less and less because invariably people expect that there will be another amnesty offered. So they sort of wait and start to engage in strategic behavior. So this is exactly what happened. I predicted in that article that it would be a very short time before there would be a call for another tax repatriation holiday. And, of course, that's exactly now what's being called for by business across the country. And by the particularly by the Republican Party, look, we need to bring this cash back that's sitting offshore. It'll be a boon to the economy, help reduce the deficit, create jobs, feed the hungry children. You name your your feed.
Yeah, well, as we know, Republicans are very much into feeding hungry children. So I'm just going to have to ask you to kind of clarify that again for me, Craig, because I'm not understanding. Because it sounds like what these corporations are doing is perfectly legal. So why do they need amnesty? Why do they need a forgiveness of taxes if they're able to?
No. Well, you're. It's a very good point because my article. What I'm trying to distinguish is, you're right, the evasion is not illegal, so they don't need an amnesty. But what I try to illustrate in the article is the psychology of offering this kind of a tax repatriation holiday ends up being the same as the psychology that's associated with a tax amnesty. In other words, this is similar in that it produces the same sort of strategic behavior on the part of the people that it's offered to. So in the case of a tax amnesty, yes, you have forgiveness of something that was done that was illegal. That's not what we have here, but what we do have is the same strategic behavior. That is, corporations take advantage of the repatriation holiday, but then first thing is they expect that there'll be another one. Because once you do it once,
sure.
Why wouldn't there be another one? And they're particularly appealing to politicians because it results in an immediate influx of money. It's temporary, and it seems like a good thing. But the problem is that it creates this idea that, okay, if there's going to be another one down the road, then let me begin to stash more money offshore, and then I'll wait. I'll never pay the 35% tax.
Right.
I'll always wait for the next repatriation holiday. If it doesn't come soon enough, then I'll pay my lobbyists to start saying, hey, it's time we had another one of these.
Right. So it becomes a permanent fixture, because why not? Why wouldn't you just, not pay and then wait for the next forgiveness period? Keep your library books at home and wait for the next time you can dump them off without a fine.
Exactly. Wow. That's exactly it.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, I was reading an article in Newsweek just this last week by Robert Samuelson, and he suggested, this was also in the 60 Minute segment that claimed that the problem is that we're taxing our multi-billion dollar corporations too high. And he proposed the same thing, which is that the 35% rate is too high, and that what we should do is lower the corporate tax rate, that 35%, and raise the capital gains tax, which he believes is too low at about 15%. And I'm just interested in your thoughts on that. Obviously, that capital gains tax being raised, although that would hit a lot of the very upper level wealthiest people in this country, it also would hit the people who, are investing in their 401ks and IRAs for retirement. And so I'm just curious what you think about that, because his idea was that to lower that top rate would make our country more competitive, more attractive to other multinationals, and would encourage investment in the United States, and of course then the whole other the whole other thing that goes along with that. Well, it will generate jobs and stimulate the economy. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, if it's the case, and the studies that we have available to us suggest that 50%, between 57 and 60% of U.S. companies doing business in the U.S. pay no federal income taxes in a given year. 42% of U.S. companies pay no U.S. income taxes for two or more years in a row in that period. It suggests to me that perhaps we don't have too high a tax rate, especially where you see that corporations have employed battalions of accountants and tax attorneys to figure out how to avoid legally paying taxes here. We've gone from an environment in which in the 60s, roughly 30 to 40% of federal income tax revenues came from corporations. So a third of federal income tax revenue came from the corporate tax. That has dropped now to around 6%.
And when did that happen?
Well, it's happened gradually over time.
There was no one big event, a tax, event that Republicans or conservatives were able to cut that for corporations. But it's just happened as a gradual thing.
It's been gradual, yes, and a lot of it, the biggest portion of that has occurred as a result of the use. As the economy has become more globalized, it's become easier to shift earnings offshore through foreign subsidiaries. And as the economy has, the global economy has increased, that's become much more common. So what you have to ask is, so what's happened to the difference? Who's picking up the difference? Because we know that, cost of government has only gotten higher if a large chunk of our income tax revenue from corporations has disappeared, then where has it been made up? That's why we have $1 trillion federal debt, and it's why we're likely to have that for some time. And it's also the case that a lot of the tax burden has been shifted from corporations to individuals as a result.
Right.
Even though wages have remained largely stagnant for the last 20 or so years, when adjusted for inflation.
Yeah, because regular American taxpayers are still waiting for all of the jobs and the benefits that are supposed to come about as a result of corporations not paying any taxes. And the very top margin of the wealthiest people in this country not paying taxes. We're still waiting for that to happen, yet things just seem to be getting worse.
Right, I agree. Well, the capital gains tax rate is low. It's at 15%. I want to point out something, your comment earlier about people making contributions to 401k. Typically, the capital gains tax is not going to hit those people because those monies that are being socked away in 401ks or 403bs, other retirement tax-favored retirement accounts, generally are not going to be subject to capital gains taxes. Depending on your plan, when you take that money out, you'll be subject to tax at your ordinary rates. But capital gains tax hits folks who are selling investments.
Right.
And not a lot of folks in the middle class, what's left of it, can say that their income every year comes from capital gains.
Right.
Yeah. The argument is made that if we increase the tax on capital gains, that will cause people who invest not to invest so much because they will realize they'll have to pay taxes on that. But for the most part, a higher capital gains tax rate would not negatively impact sort of middle class Americans.
Right.
Even capital gains from something like a sale of your residence, those are generally not taxed under other provisions of the code. So those would not typically impact the odd sale of a house here or there.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many people are making money on the sale of their homes nowadays anyway. I don't think there are many that are going to have any concern about getting capital gains off of that.
That's true. We're in a very different environment.
Yeah. So, I guess I am just amazed and I think a lot of other regular taxpaying folks are too, that it's this easy for corporations to elude their responsibilities. Because I am, in addition to doing this radio show, I'm a freelance writer, and there have been times I've looked into just things as simple as writing off the expense of a home office and my computer and whatnot. Well, I have been told it is very difficult to do that, that every minute I spend on the computer must be related to the income I then would receive from freelance writing. And what it came down to for me was that it would just be so complicated and frankly difficult just to track exactly how many minutes I would spend in that office and how much money was being generated as a result of that office in terms of my income and writing off any expenses, that it discouraged me from even attempting that. So I'm frustrated that there are corporations who find it so easy and simple to simply to make billions and billions of dollars and pay nothing. How can it be that simple?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with the power of the lobbyists that you employ. Obviously, you're not spending enough on lobbyists, Kathy, or they'd get rid of this all this attention to the home office deduction and free you up to deduct as you'd like.
Well, that's true. My millions of dollars that I have available to spend on hiring lobbyists is it's not really available right now. But that is a
kind of like my trust fund.
Yeah. Would that I had one. Well, so, Craig, I'm just curious what you, with your knowledge and background in this field, what what would you see as a fix to this? Because, like I say, there are the article in Newsweek and the 60 Minutes segment, and that what they're promoting is even greater benefits to the corporations. In other words, cutting their taxes and, well, let's just, you know, raise capital gains taxes and lower the corporate income tax, and then this will fix this problem. But do you see a fix to this? What would you think a solution might be?
Well, let me just first mention one that you hear quite frequently, which is that the United States should simply abandon worldwide taxation. Remember, I said at the outset that the U.S. believes the U.S. requires that taxes be paid on income, whether it's earned in the United States or whether it's earned abroad. Now, one possibility is this often suggested by corporations is that, well, we should move to a territorial system. The U.S. is beginning to be in the minority when it comes to this. Many other countries impose tax only on income that's earned within their borders. So if the United States said, we're only going to tax income that's earned in the United States, then we wouldn't have this problem. We would be more in line with the rest of the developed world. Let me just give you a thought problem here, Kathy. If tomorrow the United States said we're abandoning worldwide taxation, we're only going to tax you on income that you earn in the United States, income that has its source in the United States, mm-hmm. What do you suppose would be the reaction? How would people respond? Because every government action creates some sort of incentive one way or the other. So what's likely to be the incentive consequence?
Well, they would leave the United States.
I'm sorry, say that again.
They would not do business in the United States. They would move the businesses elsewhere.
Well, that's exactly right. And you're not even a tax attorney and you figured that out. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if you adopt a territorial system, the first thing that's going to happen is all of the income that's easily moved out of the country will be. So what's that? It's mobile types of income like interest and dividends and royalties. I gave the example earlier of a corporation in the United States that has a patent and decides to sell or transfer its patent to a foreign subsidiary. Okay, that's mobile income. The income that comes in for that patent in the form of a royalty can be moved. If you're not, you know, if you can move it from the United States, you can move it to the Cayman Islands, or you can move it to the Isle of Man or any one of the other offshore financial centers. So that kind of income goes first and tomorrow because it's very easy to move. So all the corporations get that passive mobile type of income outside the United States. Now we've just dramatically decimated our corporate tax base once we adopt that rule. But then pretty soon other income begins to follow. So not only will the easily movable passive income like dividends, so instead of owning shares in U.S. corporations, I own shares in foreign corporations and that sort of thing. That all goes offshore very quickly. But then gradually other income begins to move offshore as well. The income that comes from factories and plants and the more difficult to move, that begins to go offshore as well. That's already happened, not as a result of tax policy, but it's happened as a result of cheap labor.
Labor, yes.
I've seen so many of our jobs leave the United States
and go
abroad. But all of that would be accelerated in their system in which there is only territorial taxation. So to combat that, virtually every jurisdiction that has a territorial system also has to put in place some sort of a what we in the tax world would call a passive foreign investment type provision that would exclude from that territorial rule mobile income that can easily be moved abroad.
Okay.
So, so France, for example, has a territorial system. Nevertheless, they do tax certain types of passive income because it would be simply too easy to exclude that and let people move it all offshore. And that has that that has ramifications too. Our system of worldwide taxation, it's not purely about collecting the most revenue. It's also about issues of fairness, because if we didn't tax worldwide income, as I said, the passive income would all move offshore. And who owns the passive income? It's the wealthy. They're the ones who not only have that type of income, but have the resources to be able to figure out how to get it offshore. Right. The guy who's working down at the plant and, collecting wage income has no way of moving his income offshore. In fact, the government's very careful not only to make sure it gets its tax out before he ever sees his check. That's what we call withholding.
Right.
So the possibility of avoiding taxes then, if we have a territorial system, exists only for those who are wealthy, and it creates an equity issue within the system.
Right, right. I'm curious how you would rate the Obama administration on this kind of issue, Greg, on either fostering the ability of big corporations to evade their tax responsibilities, or own up to them and pay them, which none of them are. So,
right.
I suspect you wouldn't give them a very high grade, because we're not seeing that change.
Yeah, I think that this administration inherited a particular tax system that has, for years now, been increasingly exploited in this fashion.
No question.
The question is whether what is the response to that? Now, there have been calls by the administration for sort of sweeping corporate tax reform. The administration has resisted. Timothy Geithner's made very clear we're not going to do a repatriation holiday. We're pushing back on that unless we also accompany that with some sweeping corporate tax changes.
Right.
Presumably, a change in the corporate tax regime would take away some of the corporate welfare goodies that corporations presently take advantage of. So I think that this is the right approach, certainly, is to say, no tax repatriation holiday unless we reform the code. The question would then be, how do we reform the code, and what does that system look like? At the end of the day, and so far I have not seen any real solid proposals about how the code would change. And I think many corporations have been resistant to that because they do know that it could result in some pretty significant tightening up of various provisions of the corporate tax code.
And so I'm sorry, go ahead.
I can't say, we'll have to see how that plays out. I don't like the way that the Obama administration responded to the financial crisis itself.
Yeah.
We have very weak financial regulatory reform that came out of the largest economic crisis since the Great Depression, and I find that troubling. That so little momentum could be generated by middle class America in outrage at what happened, what has cost thousands of jobs and tremendous hardship for so many people. The crisis that was spawned on Wall Street has resulted in regulatory reform that's got virtually no teeth. I hope that something better happens in this area.
I confess to you that I am just also... it just boggles my mind that it seems to me that the most, the most vitriol and sort of antagonistic response has been towards the people most vulnerable and the people that have been hit hardest by the whole situation, which are the middle class, which is where most of us are. But I am in Facebook... terrible, lengthy Facebook discussions every day with people who defend the mentality that we somehow should provide everything we can for the multi-billion-dollar corporations to continue profiting and whether or not they do that at our expense, and whether or not they let us pay their taxes for them, and whether or not they, you know, ship jobs overseas to China and India, where they're having children working in factories from dawn to dusk, that doesn't seem to matter. People seem to be really mostly up in arms about somebody collecting unemployment for an additional 8 weeks. And I'm just, it's something I'm finding it hard to get my mind around, because many of the people I know I get in these discussions with are certainly none of them on the board of directors of GE. They're really middle-class people just like I am and most Americans. And so, I realize you have, that's not your area of expertise is sociology, but I do find that amazing that we seem to be in this very polarized situation where people who support these corporations' ability to do things like evade their taxes really are very, very defensive of it and believe that it actually does benefit us as a country economically.
I share your mystification about this, Kathy. It's strange, but I think that there is a bit of a strategy here of divide and conquer. You know, somebody, I'm not sure where this came from, but somebody relayed the joke, but a joke that sort of illustrates the problem. You have an extremely wealthy person, you have a Tea Party member, and you have a middle class worker all sitting around the table. Middle of the table is a plate with a dozen cookies on it. So the wealthy person reaches over and takes 11 of them, says to the Tea Party guy, "You better be careful, that guy's trying to take your cookie." And so we're all fighting at the bottom over the one cookie, and it's really successfully distracted our attention from the great wealth disparity that's occurring. And I think part of it is that people, it's very difficult to get your mind around just how big that wealth differential is. So here's a statistic for you. 74 people last year made over $50 million. There were 74. Now it was 50 million or more. Those 74 people, their combined income was more than the 19 million lowest earning people in the United States.
Yeah.
74 on one end, 19 million on the bottom end.
Stunning.
And I think that says a lot about where we are in this country, and
it does.
And what happens when you get that kind of concentration of wealth at the top is you have an inordinate ability to influence legislation and the rules that apply.
Yeah,
I think that's what we're seeing. We're moving from democracy to plutocracy.
I couldn't agree more. That brings up another point, which I think, which I hear a lot in discussions with people on the other side of my political beliefs, which is they will often say, well, the very top, you know, 1% of the wealthiest in this country are paying, and I don't have the number in front of me, but they will claim numbers like 50% of all of the income taxes. So I'm just going to throw that out, and I want to hear your response to that, because I know you have one.
Well, this goes to the what that top 1% is made up of.
Right.
So you're lumping a lot of folks in there. You're lumping the people who make over $250,000 a year, or who make $251,000 a year. You're lumping those folks in with people who are making over $50 million a year. So there's a big group there, and by using that percentage, I think you're dipping down and covering a lot of folks who are sort of upper middle class, what I would call upper middle class, because that inflates that number. But there's not a lot of income earned at the very top in the way that our income is earned in the middle class.
Not
so there
wages.
Are not a lot of super wealthy people who are, you know, who who are earning, you know, wage income.
Right, right.
So, but I happen to believe that if you have been able to benefit from the labor market that we provide here in the United States, from the educational system that we provide here in the United States, from the infrastructure, whether it be electric, whether it be transportation, whether it be water, oil, and gas, if you've managed to become extremely wealthy as a result of the freedom and the right to carry on a business in this country, then the least that you can do is you can pay your tax bill as it comes due. Now, you know, the Supreme Court has said that, you know, nobody has a duty to pay more taxes than they can get away with paying. But I do have a problem with the fact that the very wealthy people in this country spend a great deal of time figuring out how they can avoid paying back the share of the income that they've earned from a system that has made it possible for them to be in that position.
Right, exactly. They have benefited from a country that has enabled them to acquire that wealth, yet they don't want to pay back taxes into it.
That's right.
Okay, Craig, thank you so much for being with us today on Don't Shoot the Messenger. I appreciate so much your insight to this topic, because it's one that I think most of us really can't quite understand, and it's complicated. Thank you for kind of breaking that down into language that we can understand and appreciate.
Well, I hope it's been helpful, and I hope that people will think very carefully about the positions that they're advocating and think, how is this going to affect them and the rest of the middle class? I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you so much. All right. Next week, Thursday, join us again for Don't Shoot the Messenger. Thank you so much to Craig M. Boies, tax professor from DePaul University, for giving us his time and information on this whole issue of corporations who are able to evade their tax responsibilities. Craig, thank you so much. All right, I almost forgot to add my quote for the end of the day, and I stole this from our guest today, Craig Boies, who put this as an introduction to his very interesting article, his paper called Breaking Open Offshore Piggy Banks, Deferral, and the Utility of Amnesty. And so here's the quote, and it goes like this. Oh, no. What have I done? I smashed open my little boy's piggy bank. And for what? A few measly cents, not even enough to buy one beer. That is from Homer Simpson. And thank you, Craig, for sharing it. We will see you again next Thursday, 6 o'clock, on Don't Shoot the Messenger. Please don't shoot the messenger. Bye-bye.
There's a bright golden haze in the meadow. I peep out. There's a bright golden haze in the meadow. The cone is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. I say, oh, what a beautiful morning. Yeah. Yes, what a wonderful day. Y'all look out there. I've got a beautiful feeling. Everything going my way. Y'all come on now. Cattle are standing. like statues. The cattle are standing like statues. They don't turn their heads as they see me ride by. But a little brown maverick is winking her eye. She said, oh, what a beautiful morning. Yeah. Well, what a wonderful day. I want y'all to know, no, I've got a beautiful feeling. I've got everything. And everything going my way, day. Everything going my way. Y'all do it to me now.
Don't Shoot the Messenger with your host, Kathy Wynn, a Jackalope Radio production.
All the sounds of the earth are like music. The sounds of the earth are like music. The breeze is as busy, it don't miss a tree. And a little old weeping willow is laughing at me. She said, oh, what a beautiful morning. Yes, what a wonderful day. Y'all, I got a beautiful feeling. I got everything. I got everything. I got everything. Woo! Everything's going my way. I'm sorry. But I got everything going my way, my way. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. I want to thank you, little girl, for such a wonderful day. My way.